Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. We've just come out on the other side of the two major party presidential nominating conventions, and so the topic this week is obviously going to start with a P, poetry. Consider this a break from the past 2 weeks of news. My guest this week is Christopher Citro. He's a poet and the author of a recent book of poems titled The Maintenance of the Shimmy Shammy, which was a finalist for the Eugene Paul Nasser Prize. He's won numerous awards and competitions for his work, is the poetry editor for Decomp magazine, and has taught at, among other places, the University of Kansas, SUNY Oswego, and Syracuse's Downtown Writers Center. Christopher, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let me start with a question about poetry as an art form in a historical perspective. My own sense, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that poetry used to be far more prominent and influential in our culture and our popular sense than it is today. And I'm thinking of today compared with, say, 40 years ago and before that. Does that sound right to you?
Absolutely. I completely agree. Contemporary American poetry is almost largely invisible to the larger culture. There's certain exceptions, Garrison Keillor's radio shows, the writers – I forget the name of it, the writer's, his radio show. And, you know, occasionally we have a presidential inauguration that includes a poet. But largely it's invisible in the larger culture. But there's an irony to that, which is that poetry in the United States is larger, more fecund, more burgeoning than at any other time in American history. There's more poetry being written, being published in journals. There are more journals. There are more presses that publish poetry now than at any other time in American history, at least. So it's an underground culture to a certain extent. But that underground culture is extremely lively.
And what do you think happened in terms of the more visible part of this? I mean, why did poetry kind of drop in the public's awareness and appreciation? What do you think went on there?
I have a theory about that. I come from a family of school teachers, and I love school teachers. But I think that children – the way poetry is taught in school when children – for children who are young – turns off people's appreciation for poetry. Poetry is often taught as if a poem is taught as if it is a puzzle with a solution. And if you don't see what these symbols mean and this, and be able to solve the poem, then you are somehow made to feel dumb or that there's something wrong with you. Music is very similar to poetry, but people don't teach music in that way, and students are able to, or particularly young people, are able to engage with music and know that the only experience they need to gain from that is the enjoyment of it. It would be nice if people approached poetry that way. The poet Mary Ruffel has a line somewhere where she says, "You have understood a poem to the extent that you have derived enjoyment from it." Now, I came to that separately from school, but through school, it didn't sort of lead to that. So that's a theory of mine that then as people grow up, they just don't enter into a joyful, free experience of poetry. So that avenue is sort of shut off to them.
I'm going to circle back to that issue and ask you for some specific help later. But let me stick with these broader questions for now. You're a practitioner of modern poetry, and I imagine over the years there have been many different instances and versions of what was considered at that time modern poetry. But how is the modern poetry of today different from more traditional poetry?
Certainly. With contemporary American poetry, there was a time in the 20s, 30s, 40s where – particularly in the 40s and 50s in America where poetry became very academic. Scholastic. And I don't mean that negatively to the universities in that sense, but it became extremely rule-bound. It was very metric and formal, and it was very difficult to write. And the number of people who were able to write it shrunk. It got kind of small. And poetry ran the risk in that. And there was wonderful poetry that was written, but it was running the danger of sort of disappearing amongst a few rarefied practitioners. Then there was a period in the 50s where there was an explosion. Out of the constriction of it, it just exploded. The Beats, confessional poets, black poets, feminist poets, New York school poets. There's a huge list where there was just this massive burgeoning. contemporary poetry exists in the, you know, one or two generations since then, where we are the inheritors of essentially an extremely wide field of contemporary American poetry. There are things that you would – there are people writing sonnets, villanelles, poems in received forms that connect very obviously back to the history of poetry. And then there are people republishing all of the words in an issue from the New York Times and calling that a poem. And that works as a poem too. It's an extremely wide continuum of what counts as a poem, and also an extremely wide continuum of the different voices that are publishing and writing poems as well. So it's a very exciting time and a very wild time to write and read poetry.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with the poet Christopher Citro, the author of The Maintenance of the Shimmy Shammy. Well, as a more specific aspect of this broad expanse of contemporary modern poetry, you often write something called prose poetry. So describe that to me.
So prose poetry is essentially – prose poems do everything that a traditional poem does except for one thing. It does not include line breaks. Now, most people recognize a poem on the page because they'll look at it and they'll see text, and the text does not go all the way to the right margin. If it goes all the way to the right margin, that looks like prose. If it stops somewhere before that, either because a poet is working in a strict metrical thing, iambic pentameter or something, or just in free verse, there's a choice that's made to end a line, we recognize that as poetry. Mm. Alyosius Bertrand, a Belgian poet who wrote in French, invented something called prose poetry. He created prose poetry as a reaction against, like America in the 40s, a very stultifying type of academic poetry where it had to be very metrical, only very extremely rule-bound. Being a beautiful French poet, he decided to go in the complete opposite direction and do something that people didn't think you could do, which is write a poem in prose. But his prose poems do everything that we expect from poetry. It's got condensation of language, a focus on imagery, figurative language, all these different things, except there's no line breaks in it. His prose poetry inspired Baudelaire, who made prose poetry very famous. Prose poetry existed in France. It came to America during the modernist period in the 20s. William Carlos Williams, Gertrude Stein, T.S. Eliot all wrote prose poems. And then prose poetry came into respectability in the 80s and 90s. The poet Charles Simic won the Pulitzer Prize for a book of prose poetry. And now prose poetry is kind of sexy and popular. There's entire journals dedicated to it. There's conferences dedicated to it. There are certain people who feel a little reticence that you could have a poem in prose. But at this point, it's largely accepted as one of the many types of poetry that you can write nowadays.
Can you select a short prose poem that you can read to us?
Of my own?
Yes.
I would be happy to. This is called Single Male Seeks Someone Who'll Stay. I opened the door to get the paper last Sunday, and there was a goose standing on the front step. It looked up at me, then took one step to the side, making room for me to pass. So I did. What else was there to do? I walked out onto the lawn, picked up the paper, and walked back to the door. When I opened it, the goose stepped inside and waddled into the living room. I stood outside holding the door. Did a goose just walk into my house? It turned a corner and went into the hallway to the bedroom. I stepped inside. I'm following a goose into my house, I said out loud as I did. I walked through the living room, turned into the hall, just in time to see the goose fly up and out through a window I had not remembered leaving open. And then the goose flew away, I said out loud to no one. In fact, it was at that instant that I realized finally just how empty my life was.
Fascinating.
Thank you.
So your book's title, I want to ask you about that. That's curious. The Maintenance of the Shimmy Shammy. Explain that to me.
Well, the title is actually a version of the title of one of the poems in the book. The full title of that poem is Being Necessary for the Maintenance of the Shimmy Shammy. And that title, I generally write titles after I compose the poem itself. And this is a poem that I was I love the sort of anachronistic type of titling for old books where it's very long. You can see the sort of cover page where the text is centered and moving down to it. And it's a kind of thing I fall in love with as an author, titling my poems similar to things like a title and then or and then another title. That's another sort of thing. You can overdo it too much. But so for that poem, it felt right. It's sort of a sexy poem, and that felt right to have this anachronistic sort of with language that's sort of removed from contemporary times, but also with a weird word stuck in, which is the shimmy shammy, which I knew in my head had something to do with music or dance. Mm-hmm. It was only later I realized there's a 1950s song, I think maybe Bobby Darin or something, which has the word shimmy shammy in it. There's some really contemporary songs that use it as well. So I was playing with basically two levels of diction, sort of an anachronistic old-timey diction and sort of a slangy word. And then when it came to be the title, I originally had the complete title for the book, and I realized that was just too many syllables. So I used a shortened version of it. And it also seemed to work for the book as a whole, because so many of the poems in the book are love poems or poems about relationships and about trying to keep relationships alive and working. And that's sort of the maintenance part of the shimmy shimmy.
You mentioned the broad expanse of the kind of things that modern poets are doing. Are there particular new frontiers of poetry right now that are getting a lot of attention from poets and readers? Prose poetry, I guess, would be one of them. Are there other things that we could identify as a frontier of new poetry?
Yes, that's a very good question. Contemporary literary criticism and contemporary poetry criticism has, in my opinion, not kept up that well with the swift movement of the art form itself. Mm. And many writers speak to this, where there have been times in the past where there seems like there was a better back and forth between art, poetry criticism and poets and the poetry that's being written. Hopefully, there'll be some catch up to that. So there's not a lot that I can cite that I know of sort of analyses of contemporary poetry. Certainly, there are people doing it, but isolating movements, I don't know that there's movements. Mm-hmm. A lot of that has to do with our moment of poetry right now. As far as being free, as far as the genres and the types of poems that are being written, that's granted. Right now, some of the most important movements are basically whose voices are allowed to write, to be published, to be brought into the world. Queer poets, black poets, African poets, Chinese poets, Asian American poets, all this. That's a very lively area in poetry right now, which is essentially fixing mistakes of the past where these voices have been marginalized or just pushed out or not included in the conversation. That's an extremely important and lively part of contemporary poetry. Now, the poems that people are writing, they don't necessarily fall into specific types or groups. There's certainly the super experimentalists who've received the legacy of early experimental movements such as language poetry, where words are isolated for their existence as objects, not necessarily because of the semantic content of them, all the way up to extremely narrative, accessible poets like Mary Oliver, poets working in veins explored by Robert Frost, by Carl Sandburg in the past. There's largely everything goes as far as the types of poems that are being written.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Syracuse-based poet Christopher Citro. He's the author of The Maintenance of the Shimmy Shammy. I wanted to ask you a question about how the information technology revolution of the past couple decades has affected poetry. I mean, in some ways, you'd think with Twitter, messaging, other forms like that, that would seem to be conducive to a lot of people trying out poetic expression given their form. Can you say a bit about that?
Well, it's an interesting question for me because I only got my first cell phone 3 weeks ago. So, and I've composed many poems on a manual Royal typewriter. So I'm a slight Luddite when it comes to technology. But I see it happening and flying by me and whizzing by me all the time. Certainly, new information technology has entered the content of poems. There are entire movements of poetry. There's a movement of poetry, short-lived, I believe, and fairly fringe, called FLARF, which was created out of Google searches. There wasn't the sense that there was a poet consciously crafting language or speaking from her heart or his heart, in the sense it was taking the language found online and crafting poems, sort of like some of those spam emails we get with gibberish down at the bottom. That was the inspiration for Flarf, was that gibberish at the bottom. There is one thing, which is the – I believe it's 130-character limit for Twitter. There are Twitter-based poem journals that – there's a beautiful one called Cell Poems, where you receive a poem to your cell phone. I believe it's once a week or once a month, and the poems have to fit within that certain character limit. There are at least half a dozen journals that cater to this form, Twitter – poems that fit on Twitter. And as well, I should say that online literary journals, a decade ago, maybe a decade and a half ago, they had just started. For a while, they were looked down upon in the sense that they didn't have the clout that academic literary journals, peer-reviewed literary journals have. It was as if, you know, anyone could create a website, throw up their own poems up there, their friends' poems, publish them. It didn't matter. Nowadays, online literary journals are extremely lively, important, well-respected. Numerous university literary journals now only publish online, obviously because of costs. Also, a literary journal typically has – a print literary journal typically will have a print run of maybe 1,000, maybe 2,000 issues. So you think how many people will have the opportunity to read the work in there. An online literary journal can be read by tens of thousands of people all over the world, which is extremely exciting.
You wrote an interesting essay called An Elephant Walks Into a McDonald's about your experience reading poetry in a prison class. Could you just tell me briefly a little bit about that experience and what it taught you about poetry and the writing experience?
Yes, that was a very moving experience. There's a poet named Brian Daldorf who teaches at the University of Kansas, and he has run a poetry workshop in the local prison just outside of town for numerous years now. He became aware of my work as a reader in Lawrence, Kansas, and invited me to give a class. And it was the second time I had done sort of an arts outreach experience at a prison, but this time I was actually reading my poems, running a little workshop with the inmates, and I found it extremely moving. Teaching creative writing largely to university students, there's the point in life in which those students are, and the issues that they're dealing with. I found that the prisoners in that situation, where there was a naivete or perhaps an inexperience with poetry, but there was the distance between their thoughts and their feelings and the page was much, sometimes less than what you get sometimes in a university context. Almost a strange innocence, which is a strange juxtaposition to have with men who have done things that have landed them in prison, or at least in this jail. So it was a very interesting mixture of that sort of naivete and also being moved by the content that they wrote about. There was a young man who wrote about basically his brother, two brothers who are on two different paths in their life. And one brother has a serious illness and is suffering from that. And then the other brother is him, the writer, and he's ended up in jail. And thoughts about wishing that he could trade places with his brother or give his – so that his brother didn't have to live with this disease. It was extremely, extremely moving. Mm-hmm. As well with poems, there were a few poems that were sort of disturbing with violent content. But the ability that the art form gave these people in this situation to express themselves, I had known it theoretically and I had seen it just happen in general with the way poetry serves anybody in their lives if they write poetry. But giving these people in this specific context, it was moving to see how powerful the experience of writing and reading and talking about poetry was for them. I was very moved to be a part of it, even though it was just one afternoon.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is the poet, Christopher Citro. We've just got a few minutes left. And although the point of this conversation was, as I said at the outset, to take a break from politics for our listeners, I can't resist asking you a couple questions that link poetry back to that. So here's the first one. Mario Cuomo was famous for saying that you campaign in poetry and govern in prose. And setting aside whether you might agree or disagree with their policy positions, are either of the two main presidential candidates right now generating any interesting poetry, do you think?
What a wonderful question. Let's see. There are venues that respond very quickly with – there's something called the occasional poem, a poem written to respond to an occasion. There's a literary journal called Rattle, which runs a weekly series on their website where they publish occasional poems. And largely those have been responses to some of the terrible terrorist actions that we've experienced of recently. I have not seen very many poems relating to either of the two at this point official presidential candidates. But within the world of creative writing and contemporary publishing, particularly Facebook, Twitter, the conversation is largely about few things other than contemporary politics. Whether that's created lyricism or poetry, I haven't seen a lot of that. I've largely seen – you know that face that they would have on poison bottles with the X, the two mm-hmm. X's for eyes and the mouth like that? That's largely what's coming out in the discussion within the realm of poets and fiction writers.
Have you written any poems that you would consider to have some kind of political content or any kind of political implications?
That's a good question. I try, but they rarely rise out of the journal that I write my first drafts in. The great American bluegrass musician John Hartford had a line which he says, one's style is based on one's limitations. And I think that's true. There are certain avenues that I have opened to me as a writer of poetry and certain avenues that I wish were open to me as a poet but just aren't given my capabilities. When I have written poems with a lot of political content, they tend to be poems where I know where the end of the poem is going to be when I start, and I find that that creates inner poems, mm-hmm. dead poems, poems that may look like a poem and may be a beautifully crafted box with nothing alive inside of it. The types of poems I write, I don't know where they're going to go when I start. So during the process of writing it, I make a discovery. And if I do my job well enough as a poet, that moment of discovery is built into the content of the poem so that the reader makes the discovery as she moves through it. When it comes to politics, that method doesn't work for me. So I have very strong political beliefs, but they tend not to come out in my poems for these sorts of reasons. So hopefully someday maybe I'll explore that more. But at the moment, there are better poets who are able to do that than me.
We just have a few seconds left, but I wanted to squeeze this one into it. It goes back to something you said about the way poetry is taught, mm-hmm. your idea that there's a problem there. Mm-hmm. I want to offer a personal confession, if I may. Treat it like an intervention, but you've got to do this in poetry. You've only got two lines to fix me. But I consider myself reasonably intelligent, curious, decently read person. I've read some poetry, mostly as a student. I have trouble getting into it. So what am I doing wrong in a line or two?
You're doing nothing wrong. What I would say is treat the experience of reading a poem like you would listening to a piece of music. There's no wrong way to experience it. Any way that you experience that poem, even if it's being confused or feeling mystery about it, is right. You've done nothing wrong and can do nothing wrong. The poems won't hurt you. And after a while, you may feel a bit of interest, or you may laugh, or your heart may weep a little. Anything like that is a correct response to poetry.
That was Christopher Citro, and his recent book is The Maintenance of the Shimmy Shammy. Christopher, thanks so much for talking with me.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.